In 1984, William Gibson's novel Neuromancer was published, and it ushered in a new genre of science fiction writing that has since been labeled cyberpunk. The vision of a not-so-distant future Earth advanced by Gibson and others was a tough, hard-edged response to technology that included many elements of pop culture. My guest is writer and editor Bruce Sterling. He's compiled an anthology of cyberpunk writing called Mirror Shades, and he's also written several novels and short stories. The age-old debate in science fiction as to whether or not technology is good or bad may have been answered by the cyberpunk writers. For Bruce Sterling, anyway, it's no longer a question.
Technology now is an intimate thing. Technology now is an invasive thing. Technology today is the soft contact lens and cable television. It's things that burst into your living room, that get right under your skin. I mean, we're not talking about the Hoover Dam anymore, some sort of large, big project that's off by itself. We're not talking about technology as being something on a pedestal. Technology is something that affects every aspect of the modern experience.
And that's part of the theme that comes through in what could be called this quote-unquote cyberpunk movement of writing.
I think so. Yeah. I think that's probably the most profound insight that it offers. The invasive power of technology. This is, you know, it's more than a theme or a fad here. I mean, we're talking about, this is the truth about our situation.
Moving slightly away from the ideological content of the work, could we talk about some of the props of this particular brand of writing? First of all, in the first book I read was William Gibson's Neuromancer, and
yes.
And your own book, the new book, Islands in the Net. There's a preponderance of things Japanese. There's Japanese words and Japanese food and Japanese music.
Yes.
What is it? What is it about Japan that sort of fits into all of this?
Well, these people have our number. I just came back from Tokyo. I was over there for 5 days doing a gig, you know, and we're actually, cyberpunks are far better known in Japan than we are in the U.S. You know, you go to Tokyo and you just see, I mean, that is where the action is. And, you know, the 21st century is not going to be a white Anglo-Saxon situation. I mean, people talk about the use of Japanese signifiers in the work of the cyberpunks as if this were some sort of, you know, fashion accessory. But these people are for real. They're intelligent, and they're dedicated, and they're really smart, and they're very, very rich. If you want to look at things to see for real, then you've got to look at the Pacific Rim, see what's happening. Not only the Japanese, but the little dragons, you know, the newly industrializing countries. You know, the Knicks. But these people have our number now. They understand the nature of technology better, I think, than the Americans do.
Mm-hmm.
Which is why, you know, you can see that everything that Japan makes is faster, smarter, and cheaper.
One thing that's always fascinated me about this this genre, science fiction, is the ability to speculate on the reasons why things happened now. Contemporary time. You do that in your own book, Islands of the Net. You talk about the Sicilian mafia and the banks being responsible for poisoning John Paul I.
Yes,
for example. Is that part of the fun of actually writing like this, to be able to speculate on contemporary political and social and economic themes?
Sure, it is. That's a great head trip. It's a nice mind game to play. I have a tagline that goes along with that. You know, in order to understand the past, you have to understand the future.
Elaborate just a little bit.
I think that, you know, in the case of the future giving you an insight into the past, this is something that William Gibson and I are very concerned with right now, because at the moment we're working on a book which is set, it's a historical novel set in Victorian England. And I think enough time has passed now and enough sort of insight is mounted that we of the late 20th century are finally able to get a real insight into what the 19th century was up to.
This cyberpunk has been called a movement for a number of years now. And it seems like the movement itself is actually being co-opted by the medium. In other words, the ideas that are in some of the stories and some of the books have now appeared in movies or on television. Max Headroom, for example.
Yes,
Blade Runner. Does the writing cease then to have a cutting edge if the writing becomes, overrun by imitators and co-opted by movies, by television, by contemporary culture in general?
Well, there are different levels of co-optation. I mean, there's something thriving now that we refer to as sci-fiberpunk, which is essentially the standard sort of American science fiction male action adventure novels that use a few of the identifying tags and images and buzzwords, props, as you put it, of cyberpunk. And of course, Max Headroom, well, the original Max Headroom, which was invented by two people in Britain, Cucumber Graphics, Annabelle Jankel and Rocky Morton. In the hands of Jankel and Morton, Max Headroom was a rather threatening figure. In the hands of the Coca-Cola Corporation, Max Headroom is just an object to, move capital with. Yes, that can happen. It's true that the movement in 1988 is no longer the sort of table-pounding, attention-grabbing entity that it was in, say, 83. Shirley writes for Hollywood now. Gibson writes mostly for Hollywood.
This is John Shirley, William
John
Gibson.
John Shirley, yes. Right. William Gibson writes for Hollywood. Lewis Shiner is doing mainstream novels. And Rudy Rucker is involved in some seriously rad and heavy computer simulations action out in Silicon Valley. So, the point of the movement was to seize some attention for writers who, were just breaking into the field. And now that it's 5 years on, the role that we have is to, make use of the attention and actually prove what we can do.
Is that what you're doing in your own book now that's just been published in Islands in the Net?
Very definitely, yes. I mean, this is a book which really carries the war to the enemy, essentially. The thing about cyberpunk is that, fun as it was, the realms of cyberdom and the realm of punk are both actually quite insulated little territories. They're sort of subcultural ghettos. Whereas this book really does reach out to a mass audience and tries to, really grab people by the scruff of the neck and force them to confront these issues.
It does so in a way, though, that is very easy to read. Whereas, I'm going back to Neuromancer, there was this sort of wall of sound, prose style, where it was just absolutely relentless, and it didn't stop. And your book, Islands in the Net, reads like a mystery novel, It reads like a detective sort of,
yeah,
of novel. It's a little easier to take. At long stretches of time.
Well, it has what Gibson calls plot traction, which is one of the advantages of genre writing. You can use, literary techniques that are no longer considered fashionable in sort of high literature. But, it's very true. I mean, it is meant to be an accessible book. I've discovered that, if you really want to get to people, you have to get to people where they live, right? I mean, in some sense, the sort of notion of, having, say, an orange mohawk, and the safety pin business merely discredits anything you have to say. I mean, people immediately wall you off. So what you have to do is sort of come in under the radar, right? And plant ideas in people's minds that they're not equipped to instinctively reject. So that's what Islands in the Net does.
Bruce Sterling, thanks a lot for taking some time to talk to us today.
My great pleasure.
Bruce Sterling is editor of Mirror Shades, a cyberpunk anthology. His new novel, Islands in the Net, is published by Arbor House. This is Fresh Air.